The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp number 128. Today we have the staple, the steadfast. We have Mike Hammett right down there.
How's it going?
All the way from Chicago.
Damn, I did the same thing.
You did. You did. You go on autopilot. You can't help yourself. I love it. All right. We also have my favorite pirate. He was the inspiration for this mustache. We have Nick Arellano right there.
Me?
Yeah, you're the original pirate. You used to be more piratey. You're maybe less piratey now.
I'm working on it.
All right, good deal. Well, work harder. Work faster. Just concentrate and it'll grow quicker.
Will do.
Yeah, there you go. I'm trying to see if I can get these mustache curls to kind of go completely around my ears, if I could just hook them back around. And then I'll start concentrating on a comb up sort of thing. I'll just kind of right over the top of my head. It'll be great. So we have some new patrons this go around. That is folks that went to patreon.com/brotherswiss, throw us a couple of bones. They got access to our patron only Slack. So this go around, we have, I guess, a somewhat anonymous user. They just are known as Seednode, and they added their username as Seednode. So I don't know what to call them other than Seednode. So there's that fine person. Right, I'm not even sure about the gender there. But we also have Matt McElliott, and then Jordan Fox as well. So we've got three new patrons, three new brothers in the Little Brothers Wisp private patron-only Slack. So thank you guys and anyone else listening that helped support us. Appreciate it. So speaking of support, we have some sponsors. I'm going to start with our Cambium plug. So it is the same EPMP bundle that you know and love. It's the price discount, $6,000 value. You're getting it for $2,000. You get 6 months of VIPs.net automation and billing. You also get the awesome RF Elements twist horns that everybody, or rather twist board horns. Everybody's talking about those things. They're the hotness. And then you've got the 2-hour one-on-one with an EPMP network engineer. No sales pitch. You're just asking questions and you're getting real answers. You also get CN heat trial if you're so interested, so inclined. All right, the link to that is going to be in the description and in the YouTube video as well, I believe. So, Nick, read us something. What's our next sponsor?
All right, another sponsor we've had for a while is Sonar.software. It is a scalable, intuitive, comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. They have a good ticketing system, inventory, all kinds of good stuff. Check them out at Sonar.software.
Excellent. Man, I just can't wait to run over there. You've got me sold, buddy.
Yeah, check it out.
Bowl me over with that enthusiasm. I like your radio voice. All right, Mikey, what's next?
I think I did tower coverage last week, so I'll do QuickBit this week. QuickBit.com, indoor and outdoor 60 gigahertz kit that is just set it and forget it simple. Crazy feature set for the price with API, deployment tools, solid distance, and up to 8 clients per hub. I am joking. God damn.
He's just so excited about
I know.
QuickBit.
He can't hardly contain himself.
And of course, the one time I don't have any water either. K60C is now on their website.
Excellent, excellent. And that is quickbit.com, quickbit.com. All right, and our last sponsor, and I guess our newest sponsor, is towercoverage.com. Tower Coverage is your RF propagation system to empower your network. Real-time data metrics enable your coverage area, reaching your customer base, and more. The industry's best RF propagation mapping system allows website integration for customer sign-up and pre-qualification. Use this data to scientifically plan network expansion and help your WISP succeed. Get a free trial today at towercoverage.com. So thank you to all of our sponsors. I tried to ham up that last one. How'd I do?
Pretty good.
Excellent. Excellent.
I'm already on the website checking it out.
It's convenient that there's a link that you can click right there. Amazing. All right, let's get into it. So it's kind of light on details this go around. There's a couple of news items and then some stuff that I just sort of wanted to chatty chat about. And I'm super excited that Nick's here because he is our kind of, I guess, like our operations DevOps ninja guru
enthusiast,
all of that. So maybe just the knows more about it than the rest of us. So however you want to classify that, we'll get into that in just a minute. But I was looking at some of the stuff that we should look out for, and it was mostly MikroTik related. I know people I've heard before, we talk about MikroTik too much, but it's near and dear to my heart, so here it goes. The RV3011s, we have been informed that the awesome fun port flapping issue is back in version 6.48, so definitely watch out for that. I remember there was kind of like a pseudo fix in the switch chip configuration that you could kind of set in there that would help things, but I guess I'm not sure if that got rolled back or what, or evidently that's not functioning anymore. So look out for that. Maybe hold off on the 648 upgrade on your 3011s for a little minute. That's all I know about it. I don't know anymore. I'm not sure if you guys have any more details, but
I don't have any more details, but I would like to invite comments from the viewers or listeners. If they previously had 3011 port flapping issues that were solved by whichever version it was that we talked about solving it, if they actually had that, or it was just a, you know, we think this will fix it, and it did.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's hear it. Let's contact us at the Brothers Wiss or hit up Mike directly. He loves it when people bother him. That's what he always says. Please bother me right at the end of the podcast.
And kind of off on a tangent from that. So you were saying how people say we talk about MikroTik all the time. A month or two ago, I got feedback on Twitter that all we do is complain about Ubiquity. And I just want to point out that we will complain about everybody deserving to be complained about.
I guess, well, speaking of Ubiquity, I didn't add it to the list, but you brought it to the front of my mind, was Ubiquity's recent security announcement they made about how maybe possibly some of your data has been compromised, but what did somebody say? But we, they were reading in between the lines, and they said, but we don't really have good enough logging or security practices to know if they've actually accessed any of your data. So, you know, just for safe purposes, probably go change your password and all that stuff. So I assume all that stuff is out there. They said the passwords were hash, salted, all that good stuff, right? So ready for consumption at breakfast, apparently. You guys have any more details on that?
Which reminds me. No.
It didn't give much, so.
Ubiquity's not really one to volunteer information when they screw up, or even provide it under duress. So if anyone else can show otherwise, please send it to us.
Yeah, and this isn't to bash any one manufacturer. Everybody's susceptible to failure every now and then. So hopefully they'll make amends, clean up their act, and move on. Not unlike the solar wind stuff, where we keep hearing more and more fallout. You know, first we thought it was one exploit, then it was two, and now it's three, and who's to say how many more are going to come to light? I guess that's going to be the tree that keeps bearing fruit for quite a while.
Yeah, I can't think of anybody who has failed more spectacularly, back to back to back, as SolarWinds now has. I mean, it's like every time you think, okay, well, you know, there's this new exploit, and there's another one.
Oh, and then there's news about like three of their top execs. I think one of them, like a month before the exploit was announced, sold off, like, I don't know, millions. I think in total between the handful of guys, it was like over $120 million of stock sold or something like that.
It's
just before the exploit was announced.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So I'm sure that the SEC is going to have a field day with those guys. Hopefully they have gone on vacation to a non-extradition country very quickly. Otherwise, they're going to have a little prison time, I assume. I don't think you can get away with that kind of stuff, that high profile. So let's see.
Yeah, no, that's pretty, that's pretty out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if it was a smaller company that wouldn't have generated as much news, yeah, maybe, but just staying in the news like that,
Yeah, I just think about, man, there's like a ton of really good people that work there, and it was bad enough, you know, the security breaches, and if they survive that, then I would hate for this to be in the nail in the coffin for some of those people. So it just sucks, you know, the selfishness of a handful of folks. It's probably going to cost several people their jobs, or a lot of people, who knows, we'll see. It sucks how that works sometimes. Sometimes that stuff is just forced upon you. I don't accept greatness. It's thrust upon me. There you go. I don't think this exactly translates, but there it is. So there was something else, MikroTik. What was it? Andrew Cox is particularly excited about this because I know he does a lot of hotspot stuff. I'm sure a lot of folks listen to this too, but MikroTik added this IPv6 DHCP option specifically for hotspots. So supposedly if you pull an IP address via DHCP v6, it's going to pass over an option that kind of informs your client that, hey, you're actually connected to a hotspot. You need to go to an authentication page and do XYZ. I'm not sure. Is this widely supported by the major browsers and stuff like that out there? Have you guys used any of this stuff?
I have.
I don't really do a lot of hotspot stuff right now.
I wouldn't see why not. I mean, I don't know for sure, but just the number of hotspots that are out there between like hotels and stuff, it's probably not too big of a deal for a lot of the browsers and smartphones to look for that stuff already.
That's good.
So it's just another convenience thing, because the whole HTTPS redirect stuff is always weird. So being able to have some kind of option to definitively say, hey, you're on a hotspot network, authenticate here, is pretty nice.
Yeah, awesome. Looking forward to it, because I know isn't that been one of the big hangups with hotspot is IPv6 being able to, you know, because I guess users change IP addresses frequently. I don't know. I can't remember. What's the hangup with v6 and hotspot for MikroTik?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember. I know there's something. You recall what it is, Mike?
Couldn't tell
you. All right. Rock and roll. See, we got the wrong guys for that conversation, but at least it's out there. You guys can take a look at the links.
I don't use much hotspots. So.
I don't really either anymore. I used to use it more. I'm assuming in the future I'll probably use it a little bit more when I start doing some authentication stuff, but not for the moment. So I have been playing with some SD-WAN stuff, you know, so I do the automation gig during the day, and I've had a couple of people ask about, you know, like demonstrations on SD-WAN with automation, so... you know, Ansible is my poison there. So I've been sort of looking for vendors, and I've been kind of keeping note of when people are talking about it, what they're asking about. And I hear VeloCloud a lot. So I decided to start looking into it, and VeloCloud was purchased by VMware. I'm not sure how long ago, not too terribly long ago. It seems like they're not 100%. They haven't 100% deprecated. See, I didn't say depreciated. I know you guys always get on to me when I do that. They haven't 100% deprecated the name VeloCloud yet, so it sort of hangs out there. And I know the domain, like I emailed their marketing or sales or something like that, and it came from a VeloCloud account or whatever. But I think they're trying to kind of shift the product name to VMware SD-WAN. So if you're Googling, you're going to find it one or the either way, and sometimes both ways. But I decided I would give it a play. And so they have kind of an interesting like online education system that spins up sort of an instance. You can't really connect to it. It's sort of in this little hidden sandbox that you can only get through via your browser. If you actually could directly connect to that stuff, I was like, that would be awesome, because they have kind of this, what do they call it? Like a cloud controller or something like that. So it's a centralized user interface where they all phone home into that controller, and you manage them all from that single pane of glass, and everybody loves to say that, and everybody loves to hear it. But you can't actually directly connect to that. So I would have loved to have tested some automation against their API. So there's not Ansible doesn't have native VeloCloud modules, but they do have a very feature-rich API, and it's all documented very well, so I was going to play with that. I'm trying to get a demo from them. The lady was keen at first that I was talking to, and then she kind of went dead, and I've emailed her a couple of times, so I'm not sure what's going on there. Hopefully I can get sort of like a trial version or whatever. But having said all that, I got into the GUI, and I went through their little online education. I guess it was they have like a couple of different courses on there. They're actually pretty comprehensive, steps you through and shows you where all the knobs are and stuff like that. And to be honest, it is really simple to use, like their SD-WAN product. So it comes either as an appliance, like the physical appliance rated for, I guess really throughput is what they're aiming for, right? They're going to give you a beefier box if you've got more throughput at your sites. The idea being, right, with most SD-WAN, or the promise, I guess, of most SD-WAN products is you just jam a bunch of connections in there and it'll magically figure everything out for you. And it kind of does that. And you can even do like, I think it says like per packet routing, you can choose which carrier to go out of. But what's interesting about their boxes is they are constantly sampling out of all the, say you get three cheap internet connections or two cheap internet connections and you jam them into this box, it's constantly testing out of both of those whenever it's trying to reach different destinations, and it'll kind of shift traffic so that things work a little better if it can. It's really, really easy to administer though, to like set up the policies, to pre-configure a box. So you kind of pre-configure a box-ish, like it's settings. You mail it out to a site, you give them like a link, they click on the link from behind the device, and it kind of auto-provisions. It connects out to the cloud, to the device, or rather to the cloud controller. It pulls down its configuration. If you want to make modifications, I mean, it is like stupid simple. I mean, their configuration menu is like configuration, then you click on like SD-WAN nodes, and then edit. And you kind of like edit that guy, and it's got like its interface information, its policies you want to associate with. It's all really simple. I don't know why I was expecting it to be more difficult, for whatever reason. But I did notice after doing like a little bit of research, if you wanted to set up policies or like pre-prep, say you were going to roll out to 1,000 sites, you know, say you're a retail chain and you're going to roll out to, you know, 1,000 or 1,500 sites or something like that, it's a lot of clicking to get that done. So I see why people want to use automation to provision all that stuff, as well as make like idempotent configurations. So you could kind of apply that to all of your stuff in mass. And apparently you can do that. But have you guys done any other SD-WAN stuff? So I know Andrew Thrift says that Fortinet's got a fairly decent implementation. I think he's pretty proud of it. So if that guy's going to recommend it, I wholly believe in that. But this is dedicated as really just an SD-WAN appliance. It's not trying to masquerade as anything else, which is, I think, is why it is so simple to configure, right? It's like doing one thing and it's attempting to do it really well, as opposed to like your Fortinet's where they're going to do a little bit of everything. So a little bit more complexity, but you also, you know, with more complexity, you're going to get more features, more functionality. I just thought, this was an interesting product, really easy to use. I see this more on, after playing with it, it seems more like a large enterprise sort of thing. Less of what we would run into kind of on the ISP side, or, you know, like small business customers. I'm not sure though. I haven't actually seen the pricing on their appliances, but I could, like, if I was going to set up somebody's small office, I could see people wanting to use like a Fortinet for like connecting, you know, a handful of office together with an SD-WAN solution, as opposed to kind of a VeloCloud. It feels like a larger implementation sort of product. And it also kind of, you know, snaps into the VMware universe. And I'm sure if you've already got a bunch of VMware stuff, they'll probably give you discounts and stuff like that. But have you guys played with any SD-WAN stuff at all? Just curious.
Nope,
I have not.
this was my first foray into it. Really, I haven't played it really in any real way. I'm sure you all have like set up multiple internet connections that have like failover for people, right?
Oh yeah, with scripts and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, all kinds of weird kung fu.
Yep.
I think as operators, we're usually going to be on the lines of, well, why would you want a box that lets you use another operator? I'm the best that there is, so just don't even worry about it. Just buy from me and don't, just, you know, it'll never go down.
Yeah.
You know, when the operator is involved with SD-WAN stuff, you're, I mean, we all know what does happen, but then, you know, I think people think that, you know, that they look weak when they say, well, you know, when the connection goes down, you know, kind of instills into the client's mind, oh, your connections go down enough where you have a toolkit for working around it.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing about, I mean, I think it's scale. It's being able to scale, right? That's manageable if you have a handful of those things. But when you're scaling to like thousands, where you're, you know, you're managing like auto failover, especially since this thing has a ton of intelligence built into that, you know, its secret sauce is probably better than anything we could write in some Microtik Kung Fu script. So I don't know. I think you're paying for those performances and features and really just ease of use. And also you have a supported product from a vendor, so you could call them if you needed help. So there's that.
Yet, you know, it may cost you the price of a whole nother unit for the support, but you got it.
For sure. So, I had a note in here that was a follow-up from the last one, because I made a joke about my IMDb page, because I actually do have one. And I was in a documentary called The Power of Glove, and Mike found the link. They actually, you can stream it on Amazon Prime for free. So if you're interested about some of the history of the Power Glove, there's a link for you in there, which I think is hilarious.
I was meaning to watch that.
Oh, don't waste your time.
Just so that I could find you and, you know, harass you about it. But I have yet to do that. Maybe tomorrow.
All right. I had one other thing to watch that I'm actually not done with. I started it. My wife started it actually just before the podcast. And so we watched about a half hour of it. And I was dying. It's called Death to 2020. It's a Netflix special. Have you seen that? They pretend like it's serious, but it's just, I mean, it is like every 5 seconds there's a punchline. It is hilarious. It's got Samuel L. Jackson pretending to be like a New York Times reporter. You've got Hugh Grant pretending to be like a historian over in the UK. And they are just, I don't know, man, they're just tearing 2020 apart. It is hilarious. I don't care which side of the aisle you sit on or whatever. I think so long as you can laugh at your own party, because they make fun of everybody. There's some really good laughs in there for you. If you want to burn an hour and get some good endorphins going from a good laugh, that's the one for you to watch.
It's got quite the cast
too. Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of like really funny people in there. It's amazing. So here's a topic that I was really keen to have Nick on here for, because I think he's going to have some insights and some thoughts on this.
Maybe.
Oh, come on, buddy. This is brainstorm session. This is the kind of stuff that I love. Like, as soon as I started thinking about this, like all the little dopamine receptors in my brain or transmitters started firing, because I love thinking about this kind of stuff. It was Parler, the social media platform. And we're not here to discuss Parler politics necessarily, whether they should be up, whether you think it should be down. It's all around Parler. Basically, Amazon was hosting them out in AWS, out in the cloud, and they violated AWS's terms of service. We've seen the legal filings back and forth. You know, AWS sent them multiple times saying, here's examples of really vile things, you need to put in a system to, you know, check that out, take care of it. One way or the other, they got shut down. And I think they got what, like a 24-hour notice? Hey, we're about to shut you down. And so
yeah,
the real thought process starts of, hey, if you were Parler, how would you make your system sustainable and survivable against whatever, you know? Against anybody trying to shut you down. And that took me down a rabbit hole, and somebody posted a link about one of the Pirate Bay founders saying that Parler's inability to stay online was embarrassing, which is actually, so I started doing research into the Pirate Bay and how they successfully operate. So they've been in business since 2006, and they have survived all of this time after, so Parler got shut down because AWS basically said, we're not going to host you, right? There's no industry organization saying you must be down. There's no government organization saying you must be down. It was basically their provider said, we're not going to host you anymore, and they couldn't pivot, which does kind of suck. But it's not like the Pirate Bay where, you know, the anti-piracy organizations worldwide were against them. Governments, full governments were against them. And yet they still are online. They maintain that presence. So they're obviously doing something correct. And I've done a little bit of research. I've kind of done some reading on the legal stuff that they went through, but that's not necessarily what interests me more. Is how they technically went about staying up. And so I don't want to color your opinions, because I don't know if you guys have done any reading on it. I'm just curious, in the brainstorming process, what would you assume would be the best ways of keeping a controversial, subversive website online? Ready? Go.
I think the important thing I think that helps, like, the Pirate Bay is different territories' legal codes as far as hosting. And I guess their content's a little bit different because it's peer-to-peer sharing. But when it's like a social media type thing, I think it's a little bit harder, especially when you get booted from all the app stores.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because if your app's not able to be downloaded on phones, and I'm assuming that was people's primary way of interacting with it. I mean, you could always do through a browser, right?
Yeah, you probably could through a browser, but the convenience of the smartphone app, like, there was a bunch of posts when they first started having problems of, like, their mobile app hanging, and then a lot of those people just weren't even trying, like, the web interface for the site either. Mm. But I think a lot of the exposure and stuff for social media platforms is through software apps, like on the mobile phone, that they can just pop open. So it's a little bit different than something like the Pirate Bay.
That, on that, I would suspect that to kind of go a bit more generic with it, it probably depends on your user base. To, you know, and having that sort in their dedication, like,
right,
you know, this particular site you were talking about had varies. I think I saw 4 million active users in November. Just throwing spaghetti at the wall. Let's just say 3 million of them were just casual farting around. If it's not easy, they're not going to do it. But there's some number, maybe it's a million, where they are explicitly there for that purpose, and they're diehard fans. They'll get to it no matter how difficult it is to get to, as long as it's available, whether it's a browser or they have to do it on a PC or they have to type in some alternate URL to get there. There's a chunk of people,
yeah,
but which are probably the people that caused the problem anyway.
Well, let's go into the guys that you know, we're trying to keep the average user. We want 95% of these people to still be able to connect. So browser base is going to be the only way, because you can't expect all these people to, what, like, root their phones or jailbreak them or whatever, so they can get to some hidden app store. Yeah. So it's going to have to be browser based. So given the fact that in this fantasy world, this app is browser based, how are we going to go about keeping that online? I think one thing you hit on is you have to diversify. So you can't just be in one country, right? You actually have to be in various countries. So
preferably ones that have more lax laws on that type of stuff.
Yeah. Probably. And What I thought was interesting is looking at Pirate Bay, when they first started having problems, they got, I think it was like 2009, that's when the raid happened, right? And they came and they confiscated their servers. That's because they had them in a physical data center there in Sweden. Sweden apparently has kind of some lax laws that sort of helped that. But again, through pressure of different groups, different governments, it still got seized. And so ultimately, what they did was pivoted to cloud services. Right. If I host it in the cloud, there's no physical assets for these people to seize, which I thought was interesting. So Parler, I guess they're not hosting,
they kind of have the opposite problem.
They're not hosting pirated material, so it's not like anybody's gonna seize their server, right? So I guess theoretically they could go into physical data centers if they wanted to in various places. But also
technically the Pirate Bay is not hosting any illegal files either.
Yeah, they're just doing magnet links now.
Yeah, they're just holding torrent files that tell you like where the stuff's at. So if they get torn down, they just have to restore a database and the app. The actual content is distributed, so yeah. It's like they can just keep spinning stuff up.
Well, see, that got them
probably a little harder
still got,
with social media.
They still got popped. And so I learned a lot today. So they did used to host torrent files, and then they switched to magnet links, which are just like links of links. So
like an indexer.
The metaphor I heard was like, so there's a guy that has like a Rolex store you want to watch. You could go and buy it from him and you're going to pay, you know, 30 grand or whatever, and you get this watch. Or there's a guy, Donnie, on the corner that sells knockoffs for, you know, 20 bucks. And you're telling somebody that Donnie exists and, you know, where you can go and find him. That's kind of like the idea of a torrent file. Then like a magnet link, I think they said, is like you telling them that they can go and talk to a guy that knows where Donnie is. So it's, you know what I mean? It's like, it's adding these layers of sort of distance, this buffer in between things. So it kind of keeps things separated out. I was just curious in like the context of Parler, you know, what they got shut down for. I think they could host that in a lot of different places, right? And I don't think they would necessarily get shut down, at least not immediately. So I guess diversification in multiple places. Like, I don't know that, I think they would be safer hosting it on their own servers someplace than they would in just a traditional cloud provider. Cause I would think that a cloud provider, you know, obviously we've already seen it happen. You know, they've been blackballed by AWS and Google over here. And I'm sure Azure doesn't want to host their content either. I'm not sure if they already publicly said one way or the other or not. But it seems like if they had their own servers outside of the country, now their load times are going to take a hit from that. You know, how large, I'm not sure. But we're so used to, you know, flipping Facebook as fast as it'll go, and it just loads and loads and loads, right? Because we have that local content, that local cache. You know, if you're going out of country, those load times are going to increase and make the app less usable. But I guess the diehards will want to stay with that anyway. I mean, I don't know. I guess if you don't have any other options, if you've given up, you know, your Facebooks and stuff, what do you?
Sure. Yeah. Speaking generically, esoterically, yes, you would have to diversify your country based on many parameters, the country in which your company is organized. You would need to have more than one company in more than one jurisdiction, because, you know, if it's the US or something in the EU or whatever, you know, they can flex their muscles to other jurisdictions that respect them and still get what they want. So you gotta choose multiple jurisdictions for your organization. You know, sometimes as the U.S. government said, well, you know, Microsoft, you're a U.S. company, and we don't like what you're doing over in wherever, you know, fix that. And they eventually capitulate. So you got to have something where the U.S. can't reach you. But then also, where somebody else can't reach you. You know, U.S. can't reach you in Russia, but then if you piss off Russia, you can't just be in Russia. You got, you know, you have to have multiple jurisdictions that would be at odds with each other.
Yeah.
So that way you can keep your organization. And then same with where you put the equipment. And then same with the country of ownership of the data centers that own the buildings where you put your equipment. And the country of origin for your transit providers. Because the U.S. could say, hey, level three, shut off that service that's over in Mumbai. So they shut you off. But the U.S. government can't tell RETN, the Russian telecom, to shut you off. Mm. They're gonna tell you to go fly a kite. So
yeah,
you have to abstract all of these layers and diversify them all over the place.
Well, too, it's like something I hadn't necessarily thought about, but somebody brought up was the domain name. So the Pirate Bay was originally .org, and so that domain got seized. So they ended up switching it, I think, to a .se domain, and that one was in kind of a neutral country where, you know, it wasn't going to get seized and snatched away from or whatever. So that was kind of their more long-term solution. But also, the domains started getting blocked in certain countries, like the UK. You couldn't get to the Pirate Bay. So they started spinning up all of these mirror sites, you know, for just different URLs. And then they ended up hosting web pages that had just lists of the various mirror sites. So it's like, man, it's like this.
You can always find it again.
It's this weird chicken and egg game.
It's literally a pirate ship.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I was thinking, it's so crazy that Pirate Bay does still exist. I went in there and I browsed it, and I saw some stuff all the way back from 2008. There were some magnet links that were still active in there. And then there was some stuff from like 2 days ago that was active. So it's, I mean, it's still up and active. It's still trucking along. One of the things they did is, I think in after the seizure in 2009, you know, they had to kind of regroup. So the main three guys that started it supposedly backed out. They all got 1 year prison sentences. They all fled and individually got caught over time and then served, I think, 10 months. But it's still run by kind of a shadow team of people that are keeping the Pirate Bay alive, like these unknown anonymous figures. And supposedly they even have backup in case they get caught. You know, it's pretty wacky. They're basically saying it's more an idea. And killing an idea is a lot harder than killing a website, right? And that's
the, you're distributed.
Yeah.
Someone will just pop it back up.
But they said the physical way, the technical way that they've been keeping it up is they have routers, I guess is what they call them. I'm not sure if they're trying to insinuate that those are physical routers or just kind of like routing servers or services. And these routers, so the domain will point to there. So whenever you browse, you go there, then that will distribute you to load balancers that are in multiple countries all over the place. Between the load balancer and the hosting provider, it's an encrypted tunnel. And so all the traffic goes from the load balancer to the endpoint encrypted. And then the drives are encrypted that everything lives on. And since they've made the migration to this infrastructure, they work on public cloud services. So they're on hosted cloud services, but the cloud provider doesn't know what's going on inside there because it's all done through encrypted tunnels with encrypted drives. And it's interesting. So if like any of the servers, so any of the cloud providers, like any of the instances they have spun up or whatever, if those go offline for X amount of time, then the systems basically lock themselves and they're no longer accessible. They're gone. So they kind of like, it's like a scrub system or whatever. So I thought that was fascinating. And then I think even the load balancers, maybe, I'm not even sure how far down the rabbit hole that goes, but maybe even if the load balancer falls offline for long enough, then it gets locked. And I think they said that the load balancers are running purely in RAM. So they're just like basically memory-based machines that exist in like all these various countries. to do all the distribution with. So I thought that was pretty brilliant. So you could still operate on AWS. You're just going through a shell company and all the connectivity is coming encrypted to the servers through load balancer. So I guess it would, like in Parler's case, you probably could still host in AWS, but you would have to go out of country, you know, hit one of those route servers, load balancers, come through a tunnel back to the US and then hairpin back and forth. So you could theoretically host anywhere in that instance.
But still, it comes down to the content. So, I mean, one is hosting magnet links, and one is a social media platform with probably media content, you know, videos, photos.
Yeah, tons of streaming content.
So that takes it to
content.
A whole new scale that's a lot more difficult to just spin up and tear down.
So how you fix that is middle-out compression.
Middle-out, yeah. Simple as that.
So I thought that was a pretty clever solution. They were saying that like the Pirate Bay, you can grab their database. Like it's freely available to download, and it's only, I think it's like 100 megs, because it's really just magnet links, right? It's just little, it's just text links. That's all that stuff is. Mm-hmm. And the site itself, I mean, you've seen it. It's probably like 5 megs worth of stuff. There's not that much there.
Yeah, not much going on.
Yeah, and so.
Not that I've ever been there, but
Of course not. Well, I mean, for research purposes, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to get some ISOs for stuff that's legal.
Obviously.
Like Linux, you know.
A copy of the Bible in text form.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. They're two very different animals for sure. It just seems like there are fascinating ways you could go about doing this, and it's all I guess just diversification is how you'd have to do it, right? You can't put all your eggs in one basket. You got to move all that stuff around. But yeah, what happens when the U.S. government wants to go after you? That's going to be tough, because all the money comes from the states, right? All the people investing in this thing. So
for the most controversial content, you know, we'll have to go through all these steps. But really, in the case of Parler, which is what the root of all this, conversation is, at least as of the time that they were taken down, the U.S. government wasn't pursuing them for anything.
Right, right.
It was all private decisions. You know, Google decided not want to do business with them. Apple decided not to want to do business with them. AWS side, not to do business.
Once the first domino fell, they all just.
So there's nothing to say that you couldn't stand up, you know, buy a cage in Equinix and just, here's my servers. Now, it's not to say that that wouldn't eventually happen, because I guess things on there were pretty raunchy. So at some point, the government's going to come knocking. But currently, you just, here's my servers, here's my IP, you don't got to hide anything, I've got a big fat Juniper router or whatever, and it's just, okay, well, level 3 doesn't want to work with me anymore, now I got a circuit from GTT.
Yeah. Just buy something from everybody. Yeah, and I guess as a stopgap, that would work, but, I mean, you'd have to see the writing on the wall to some extent, right, and then think, all right, I've got to diversify this thing ASAP. So stopgap, here's some physical servers. Here's the backup, restore it on here, get everything back online. Now let's start making this thing resilient.
I mean, and all this stuff is complicated, but it's probably just as complicated to try to build some kind of content filtering system to be compliant, or at least try, with that much data. I mean, even the big companies can't do it very well, and they get fined all the time.
Yeah. Well, and also think about the head start that like Facebook has.
Oh, for sure.
That's like
just the number of employees.
Yeah, that's like what MikroTik says when you talk to them about somebody else like making a routing engine or something. What is that? Like, I think Giannis said when Ubiquiti announced their line of routers, they said he said something like, "The routing is steep mountain to climb." Like, you know, it's like, good luck. You know, we've been at this for a long time. So, there you go.
Well, they use Viata, so.
Kind of cheated a bit.
little bit.
It, well, and then, what I found interesting is I didn't know this for the first few days after the takedown, which is almost more of a surprise to me than anything else in this. Parler was running on WordPress. I had no no idea.
That's crazy.
That WordPress could scale that high.
Well, just that anybody would run a social media platform on WordPress. What was it? Was it like just an iframe for the stuff, like for the social media part in the background or something?
I mean, you know, I don't know, but the fact that they got WordPress to scale high enough to handle that many active users. I mean, the genius it would have taken to make that happen at the same time of why didn't you just make something that wasn't WordPress?
I think maybe they were doing kind of a fake it till you make it situation, you know? And then all of a sudden the growth was just
got caught up in it.
Well, I think the growth was probably just exponential beyond what they had anticipated. Right? It's like you start small, you just get it working, or there's a proof of concept. Oh yeah, see, it's doing all the things. And then, you know, once you get your, I guess your marketing piece, your advertisement stuff established, you get money coming in, then you build the real thing. Is that the idea? Slowly swap it in. That's crazy, running on WordPress. Rock and roll, man.
I mean, you can run WordPress serverless. It's PHP. So you could scale it pretty easy on like Amazon or whatever.
All right, Nick. So you're gonna make Parler 2.0. How would you go about WordPress designing it?
WordPress. not WordPress. I have a very deep hatred for WordPress.
Yeah. I've tried to avoid it my whole life too, and it's a couple times it's been like, okay, we'll just do
whatever,
that.
Man. I went from PHP Nuke to WordPress. That's my bread and butter.
I wouldn't want to get into the social media game. It'd be too hard.
All right. Well,
it's hard to approximate the data, but I mean, a lot of other services, you can do all kinds of things for like caching, but the data is always just so dynamic all the time that it's hard to scale it the same way. It has its own set of challenges that are unique to like social media, especially if it goes viral, like trying to keep up with that and engineering it in a way to handle just the sheer amount of users that could jump in to participate.
And all the media that you're saving too, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, video.
Video, pictures, all that crap. You've got to be able to store that in a succinct manner, be able to retrieve it.
Well, and even
quickly.
If you build it out into like AWS services for like the video for compression and use all the tools, like just the amount of money you would have to pay at the end of the day to run all that stuff and, you know, try to support a staff, like it would just be extremely difficult. Hmm. At least from my perspective anyway.
Really, I was trying to, you know, figure it out, and it's like, you know, I'm mostly a network guy. I mean, I do servers, say probably better than average, but development or automation or anything like that, I'm like a 4 out of 100. And so it's like, I can sit there and I can think, okay, you know, here's how I can build the infrastructure to do all this. And you know, what the turnaround would be on getting this type of equipment. Okay, you know, most of it you could probably even get by with used stuff, and that, you know, piles of used switches and things. But then to think, if you were to turn around and build a new Parler that's independent, were you going to just... How fast does it take you to get 5,000 servers?
Yeah, I was gonna say what did they have? I mean, like didn't they have like a 300% increase in like a single month or something like that? Like it just started exploding and getting worse and worse. And
if you can't leverage auto scaling and you have no way to anticipate growth, like
you've
good
got
luck.
Physical servers and you need to scale at that rate, like that's impossible with physical infrastructure. Because they couldn't forecast that was fixing to happen. You know what I mean? And even if it started happening and they thought, oh, let's fix it for next month, there's still not enough time to build that much infrastructure, like physical infrastructure.
I mean, how long would it take you to identify the data centers that have the available square footage and wattage capacity and then get them to provision that space for you?
Ordering a circuit's 90 days, 90 days minimum.
And then getting the circuit delivered to the data center, cage to do it. And then, okay, so that's gonna take a long time. But you can't start that until you know what the ID is of your cage and your rack and whatnot. So you can't even start the circuit order until...
Yeah.
Well, you could start the transit orders, or you couldn't do the cross-connect, I guess, until then.
Well, something I was thinking about is, too, a lot of data centers have their own DIA, right? They'll sell you a blended product, and they can generally turn that up in a day, right? So there's your stopgap, but... If you were Parler came to me right now,
but can you get 400 gigs?
If you were Parler and you wanted 5 megs and you came to me, I would say no, because like I don't want that kind of heat on my network. You know what I mean? Maybe I'll stick you in a cage and let you get somebody else's connectivity, but oh my god, just the sheer number of attacks that you would have to be fending off on probably an hourly basis.
Especially if you're controversial.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Knowing who they are.
Yeah.
It's like, right. I wouldn't get anywhere near them. It's just that. That's a whole set of nightmares that I wouldn't want to deal with.
I would, all that seems to me, anyway, easy to deal with than where do I find... And how quickly can I get 5,000 servers?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's like, that's the critical piece. Like, if you can't do that, there's no point in even passing go.
Because your service will be offline, and then you're going to try to scale it up, but the service is offline, so people are going to leave, and it's you lose already.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking
if you need 5 and you only have 2, you might as well have 0.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because so if the experience is bad, people are going to walk away.
I know that you can get, I know there's going to be 5,000 used servers out there, but then you got to build your environment off of just random stuff. Like, used MX960s. You can find them. They're going to be pretty much the same. And that's going to support what you need from an infrastructure perspective, just ballparking. You can find them, you can get them turned up, you can configure, you can get the line cards. I don't doubt that you could get all that done in 2 weeks. But to get 5,000 servers that are similar enough where you could, because if you have different types of servers, then you just made it harder for your software guy to configure all of the, load balancing and, this runs on this platform, this runs on there. Like, that just makes that job so much harder if you've got, 10% of them have 4 sockets. Another, few thousand servers have 2 sockets. Oh, I got a bunch of single socket servers, not to mention the RAM differences, not to mention the storage difference. Like, this is something that can really be fulfilled with a new product purchase. And who's going to ship 5,000 servers?
Yeah. Something I was thinking is you could probably, there's other cloud providers like Alibaba, the guys out of China, they have their own cloud service. Maybe they would be a little bit more friendly to that kind of stuff. Maybe they would care a little bit less than the American companies. But then again, you're having to host all of your stuff.
Give them backdoor access to the data.
You're having to host all of your stuff.
Join the party.
Basically, in the Chinese government's website or servers. And don't you know they would want to harvest all that information? So it's kind of pretty sure that's not what you're wanting to do. But you could.
Well, I guess, shortest path to resolution is Alibaba Cloud.
There you go.
Because
Easy.
While China is no fan of free speech, if it's free speech against the U.S., they will give it to you for free. You ain't got to pay for it. Just say, hey, AliCloud, I'm Parler. I'm showing up.
Yeah.
Here you go.
That's like that.
Cause some more dissent within the U.S.
That's like that web comic where this guy is standing next to this lady at a little kid's lemonade stand. He goes, it's free, but, you know, they sell your data, so. Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Okay. I'll take four.
Yeah. That's interesting. Just the whole thought experiment of all of that stuff combined. Sounds like Parler was in the right place at the right time. They just weren't prepared for it. But, you know, how often are people totally prepared to win the lottery? I don't think, you know what I mean? I don't think people have like this big, long plan already set up with lawyers and, you know, all the documentation before they win the lottery. So I think it's just, you know, it fell in their lap. They were ill prepared for it and they'll just be another casualty. I guess it'll be kind of a joke around the water cooler from now on. Remember Parler? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now from what I gather, look, I heard that Parler found a home with a company called Epic. But then upon further research, it appears as though that they really only found that home for their DNS registrar. In that, as I was digging into Epic a little bit, it seems as though that because Epic is a fairly free speech friendly registrar, and other, I think some other services as well. Seems as though that they have had a hard time finding a home. You know, they've been kicked off of Linode, however you pronounce that. They've been kicked off of one of the other, you know, hosting companies. But it kind of circles back to, well, yeah, it's somebody else who you're just living on their hardware. It's the same thing. It just, these companies that have controversial stuff can't ever figure out how to do their own infrastructure. Like, you know you're going to post crap that people don't want. Why don't you be a little more resilient from the start?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's, at least in my day job, that's what I hear about. I mean, pretty much nonstop is cloud. We're moving to cloud. We're migrating this to cloud. And, you know, it's, I'm sure that Parler wanted to go to it for all the same reasons as everybody else. But what happens? Yeah. What happens when the cloud's not there for you? I guess people aren't thinking about that or anticipating that. Like, what if the cloud's not an option? How do I do this stuff now? And you have to, I guess, go in your time machine back how we used to do it in the olden days.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, cloud is just somebody else's server. It's just somebody else is buying and racking the servers. Granted, in the case of, you know, Amazon and Google and whatnot, they're specialized servers. You know, they've designed their own. You know, it doesn't even look like a server to us anymore with what they've been doing. But it's still, someone's still printing PCBs and putting chips on them and, you know, putting them in some sort of physical container, whatever that container looks like. Someone's still plugging power cords and, you know, fiber cables into them.
Yeah. What do you do when they decide to pick up their ball and go home?
And so I guess you would almost need somebody who had kind of not, you know, who had worked on building the underlying software that builds these kinds of infrastructures. Because you can, you know, while it's not as efficient, you know, you can just go buy 5,000 Dell servers and put them in a bunch of racks and it would function similarly. Not as efficiently, but similarly. But that interface is abstracted, you know, from, you know, AWS and all these fancy, you know, auto scaling dynamic, all the, you know, auto provisioning more servers to handle the loads and this and that, you know.
A lot of that stuff's built.
Well, the other big thing, too, is that, you know, Amazon has private fiber to all their data centers. So you deploy an app on AWS in, like, US East. Well, you can also have your app set up so that it's served on a CDN globally. So if someone in Japan, all they have to do is hit Amazon's first pop, and then it rides private fiber, you know, hundreds of gigabits of capacity to where your app is. Like, it's hard to get that kind of delivery on your own.
It, you know, but, you know, I mean, coming from the network side of things, to me, it's like, okay, well, yeah, you just, I mean, it, I know it's not exactly this simple, but yeah, it's just order some more connections, order some bigger routers, order some more line cards. To me, not being so much on the software side, it's like, how do you build the underlying software that does the provisioning of the new containers and things to support the auto scaling software on top?
It's like, I think a chunk of that stuff's,
how would you even do that?
Like open source. Like all of Google's infrastructure is built on Kubernetes, right? So the Kubernetes or K8s, whatever people want to call it, was their product, and they open sourced it, and now, you know, that's kind of what people are using for that scale. So then, like, Red Hat even sells like an enterprise ready supported version called OpenShift. So I think it's pretty, it's got a,
so maybe it's not as hard as I think it is. I'm just like, I don't know how to start that conversation.
I say that,
but apparently
I've never spun it up. I've never maintained it. So I can't pretend like it's easy or anything like that. I just know that it's out there. It's stable. It's a very mature product. Like those sorts of things are.
Well, it's cool. I mean, like, as much as I despise YAML, I mean, the fact that you can do, like, code to infrastructure and have this Kubernetes software orchestrate the network stack and the storage stack and the containers, and it has, like, health checks built in. So I've been learning a little bit about Google's Golang, and a lot of that stuff is made for microservices and Kubernetes autoscaling and being able to build little health checkpoints in your apps to have Kubernetes be able to just, like, kill and spin up new containers. Like, it's kind of an awesome system, but it is quite complicated.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's a whole ecosystem. It's a thing of its own, right? It's its own continent with its own government, its own crazy political parties. And I know there's a lot of snap-ins. So, like, there's a lot of vendors who've created products just for snapping into Kubernetes, like security products, networking products. There's definitely, it's got inertia. It's one of the largest projects, like out on GitHub or whatever, the most commits and things like that. It's way up there. So definitely that stuff is alive and well. It's just beyond me. But I think at this point, I've decided that this year I'm going to start using kind of the OpenShift stuff, the Kubernetes stuff, and start learning to use that. I need to diversify myself. I can't just be an Ansible guy. I got to start being something else guy. And to me, like, from the momentum I've been seeing,
the rest of the company Kool-Aid.
Well, no. This is self-preservation, brother. So from the momentum I've seen, there's a lot of movement towards that stuff, so I need to move towards it as well. Right? I don't want to get pigeonholed as just a person that knows Ansible, and then I don't know. Like, I have all these unfounded fears about everything, which is what keeps me moving, right? It keeps me spry and nimble. But, you know, it's like, what happens if for whatever reason Ansible doesn't have the groundswell that it used to? Well, then I need to, you know, have like a plan B. But really, it's just to make myself more useful. You know, like more useful to the company means more likely that I'll still be there tomorrow. So you never know what happens, right? You just gotta be ready for anything. Not that I have any worries, but it's just my normal neuroses, I guess. Nothing abnormal. Well, that's all I had on the list. Curious if you guys have anything of interest that you want to add. Nick, what's new? What's happening? You were going to be on here last time with us, but stuff was blowing up. So what's...
I've been no-lifing work the last couple weeks, so I haven't got to do much fun stuff.
Gotcha. Fun stuff like stay in your house, isolated from everybody else?
No, like work on my projects.
Oh, gotcha. Well, have you broke out the VR yet?
Nope. I haven't played any video games. Haven't really watched much media. I've just been working. So,
That's lame.
did a bunch of cool Udemy stuff. Just mass configured firewalls across like 50 towers, so now they're all standardized.
Oh, that's baller.
So that was great. But yeah, that's about it. Pretty boring.
Oh, that's cool. Very cool. Well, Mikey, have you got anything cooking? Anything new, interesting?
Interesting. Well, I spent a week look or I'm rounding it up to a week. It's maybe 3.5 or 4 days, looking at applications. That was exciting. I look at lots of grossly underqualified people applying for rudimentary positions.
Hey man, sometimes you just need the right attitude, the right aptitude.
Well, so we had one guy applying to be a sysadmin. And the intent is I hand over passwords and IPs and then just say, here's a list of shit to do, go do it. Well, one guy that applied for that job, his work experience largely includes being a personal shopper at an area grocery store.
Oh, cool. That translates.
With no education to support it. So it's like, okay, well, I don't think this will work for you.
Yeah, did you read the job description? I
If you don't ask the question, you'll never get anything.
guess that's true.
And so there was a lot of people like that where I'm like, there is no possible chance that this would ever work for you. And then there were a bunch of people who it was, they were reaching up from where they were, they were, had spent, 6, 7 years doing desktop support, and they were, level three techs, and they were, they were just looking for, a junior sysadmin would be the next step.
Right.
Only I was looking for senior, not junior. There's a bunch of those. And then I got a guy. I'll leave out the distribution in case that in some way identifies him, but there was a guy that applied who was the co-founder of the mobile division of one of the major Linux distributions. I'm like, his resume includes, I improved, kernel latency XYZ by that. I'm like, huh? It's like this guy also didn't appear to read the application or the job posting because this guy is the smartest guy I've ever seen. And then at the end, he said, I would, I can't wait to put my PBX skills to use. So he actually did read it because then there mentions about, deploying and maintaining PBXs. So I'm puzzled as to why a guy who has been a kernel developer and co-founded a Linux distribution wants to be my
I don't
sysadmin.
know, man. Some people just like turning wrenches, you know?
Maybe they like you, Mike. Maybe they've seen the podcast.
Maybe. Maybe. He's like, that guy needs a lot of help. I know, I can stay there for a while.
Well, this guy says he doesn't want anybody talking to him. That's just the guy I want to work for.
There you go.
It could be, but and then, it's so, I was looking for, sysadmin, network admin type posts, and also looking for field techs, and there's just a whole bunch of people that have, I got landscapers applying, and it's like, have you spliced fiber before as a landscaper? Have you, if I told you, I mean, I could tell you anything, you wouldn't even know what I was talking about. You have no concept for most of the stuff. But then I got a couple guys that worked for AT&T. Well, still work for AT&T. They've put in 15, 20 years there. Both of them kind of indicate that they're worried about not making the next round of layoffs and looking to move before, on their choice, not somebody
Right
else's.
on their time. Yeah.
Yeah. It, you know, and, you know, one of them, he's got a real impressive resume with, you know, projects he worked on at AT&T for, you know, doing field tech stuff. It's like, all right, this guy's good. Far better than the landscaper.
All right, well, good deal, man. Well, congrats. I know you've been working on getting some additional support for quite a while, so hopefully that sort of works out for you.
Out of all that, I'm hoping to get three or four guys. So then that'll be a load off. Maybe I can actually get some work done for a change.
I wouldn't hold my breath. Let's see. What have I been working on? This last week, I worked on CI/CD pipeline demo. I've had a couple of people ask about it, so I thought I figured I should probably figure out some kind of way to demonstrate that stuff. And CI/CD was a new concept to me until, I don't know, I started working at Red Hat. Let's be honest. I learned most of...
We talked about it a little while ago, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was all still new to me. Yeah. It's the idea, right, where you, like... continuous integration, continuous development, you make like a code commit and then some automated mechanisms grab that and then do some testing on it and then roll it out to your infrastructure and then migrate it into production for you, right? It's like kind of like magic. And so Jimmy did a demonstration, Jimmy Connor, he's in the Little Brothers with Slack. He's also one of my cohorts, my associates. You know, he works on the same team as me. I'm not sure what to... We're not on the same level, obviously. This guy's some kind of crazy man. But he does one with VMware. So he would deploy a web app. So I was like, I'll do that. So I gave a whack at it. And then I asked him, hey, can I see your playbooks on the back end? And then I fixed mine after looking at his because he did it so much more efficiently than I did. But it's the idea of mine's really simple. And I don't use cloud-based infrastructure because I've seen a lot of people, I mean, most of what you think about of CI/CD, right? I'm sure Nick is very much this way, is that you think about rolling services out to the cloud. So it's kind of a novel approach to do it with sort of VMware. The idea of treating your servers like cattle as opposed to pets, right? It's things that you can bring up and tear down. You don't care really about their longevity. It's just kind of, you're there to serve a purpose, and when your purpose ceases to exist, so do you. But what mine does is I go to a HTML page I have on my GitHub. I make a change to it, and then it calls a webhook in Ansible user interface. It's called Tower now. I have a sneaking suspicion we're not going to be calling it Tower forever. Apparently, they change names of things a lot at Red Hat, so I just got to get used to that. But it's the kind of the GUI, the API interface. So it calls that, and then that kicks off this workflow. So the first thing I do is I link clone a VMware template, which honestly... it takes about 20 seconds, and I've got an up and running CentOS 8 VM. I'm assuming in the future I'll change it from CentOS 8 to something else. I don't want to get into that conversation right now.
Something else that exists.
I don't want to get into that conversation right now. I just thought I would head that off the pass. but yeah, so it spins that up, and then it installs Nginx. It can, and then in another step, it configures Nginx, and then after that, it actually does some testing to make sure that the web server's up, you know, because it pulled the new HTML, make sure that it's working. Then it updates the load balancer config, tests that, and then it deletes the old application server, renames the new one to what the old one was, updates the inventories, and Bob's your uncle, you're done. And it's crazy. All you do is one commit to an HTML page, and it just magically rotates your infrastructure. And that is, like, so crazy to think about. Like, it's just, it's bonkers. I know, Nick, that's blasé, boring. For
well, if you're like a single developer, it's super helpful to have these pipelines in place. So, and there's other things like I have a couple desktop apps I'm building with Electron, which is like use web technologies to build desktop applications, and you can do things like, for example, GitHub has all this functionality built in, where I can deploy the code and it will build the Linux, Windows, and macOS like binaries for me. And it'll run all the test suites. And if there's any kind of issue or error, it will not deploy the code to production. And you can set up like Slack or Discord alerts to let you know what failed. And so it's like having kind of like a QA team. As long as your testing is good and you have good coverage, right, It'll catch things and make sure you don't deploy code that breaks and causes issues for people using the production system. So it's pretty awesome. And most of the services, especially for small projects like GitHub's free tier for this stuff, it'd be really hard as for a small tool to like use all the allowances they give you. So it's basically free, and it's kind of built into the source control that I'm using. So.
That's cool. That's cool. This stuff, it fascinates me. I've always liked the idea of like Rube Goldberg machines and like automation, really just in general. So the idea of I push one thing and then, you know, it's like dun 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 dun, you just all these things start marching and moving. Obviously all that I put in place, all the testing, all the checks that you build yourself, but just to watch it all move in a reliable fashion is
Yeah.
so satisfying. I need to figure out how to do this kind of in a network fashion, but we don't generally just throw a router in the trash and then spin up a new router because that's just, I don't know, you license problems with that. So I don't know that there's necessarily an equivalent in the network world to a CI/CD pipeline where you just,
That'd be a little harder.
yeah, it just, I don't know, it sort of doesn't translate. I guess, you know, it's like, it's just a different, it's a different sort of thing, but it's a pretty cool concept that is sort of weird to, I don't know, like just my old man brain, it didn't really appeal to me at first until I started using it. Until I, you know, once you really start needing to do real enterprise things, this makes so much more sense. You know, instead of having to like curate every individual server, if I need a new web server, I can just update, like do all the updates on the base template, make sure it's good, and then I can just tell my infrastructure, hey, redeploy using the new image. And then all those new security updates, all the new tweaks that I've made, it's magically on everything and it's working. I don't have to touch each individual box and do all this. It's just, it's crazy how much easier things get when you start doing this.
And safer.
Yes, the ability to redeploy something, like one of your
Yeah.
servers gets compromised, you just take it offline and then fire off your pipeline, tell it to redeploy. You've got a new one up while you're, you know, doing triage, figuring out what happened to that old one or whatever. So there's just a lot of things, a lot of functionality. It opens up a lot of avenues for you that you didn't have before. But that's probably so far outside of the realm of what folks listening to this are interested in. But we'll stick a fork in it right there. All right, man. We are at our kind of customary hour 15, hour 20, hour 30 mark. We're actually at about an hour and 20. So you guys have anything pressing or are you ready to stick a fork in it?
No,
All right.
I'm good.
Let's kill it. Let's put it to bed. All right, Mikey from Chicagoland. If folks want to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
Patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp.
Booyah. Jump in there. And Nick Arellano, folks out on the internet that want to steal some of that brain power you got. You have a very wrinkled brain. You're not smooth brain like me. Very wrinkled in there. If people want
Depends what side you look at.
to if people want to get a hold of you, how do they do that, bud?
Also, the Little Brothers Wisp Slack group, or you can email me at nick.a@hey.com.
There you go. The way to be.
Nice and short.
Easy peasy. You want to get a hold of me? I'm Greg at gregsoul.com or contact us at the Brothers Wisp. All that stuff comes to me anyway. I very regularly blog at gregsoul.com. I guess question comments, please fire them our way. If you want to support the podcast, become a patron, get access to the Slack. That's patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. And I'll stop this recording. And then I'll come over here and I will stop this recording.
Give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.